This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, how should the next U.S. president deal with Vladimir Putin's Russia? Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. We are at a potential turning point in U.S.-Russian relations. With the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Syria, the rise of far-right political parties in Europe and their ideological affiliation with the Kremlin, and alleged Russian interference in the U.S. presidential election, the next U.S. president will need a clear and definitive strategy for addressing Putin's Russia. With us to analyze the nature of the threat from Russia and what that means for a new U.S. president are two distinguished analysts. Jeffrey Mankoff is deputy director of and senior fellow in the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's a think tank here in Washington, and Ilya Zaslavsky. He's a visiting senior fellow at the London-based Legatum Institute, a nonprofit entity devoted to sustainable human development. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Well, let me begin with you, Jeffrey Mankoff. You've been here at the microphones many times talking about Russia. Let's talk about the Russia factor in the U.S. presidential election. We now know that U.S. intelligence agencies have said that Russia was behind the hacking of the Democratic National Committee and the emails of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, John Podesta. Now, while such cyber espionage may not be new, making that information public by handing it over to WikiLeaks is arguably relatively new, and it does lead to serious concerns about Russian use of cyber espionage to interfere in the U.S. election, either on the side of Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, or perhaps to undermine faith in our democratic system. Some are worried even about attempts by Russia to cause panic and confusion around vote counting on our election day, November 8th. This could play into Donald Trump's allegations or unsubstantiated warnings about a so-called rigged election. So as we approach election day, how concerned are you that Russia may even attempt some kind of a cyber assault to cause panic or chaos? And are we prepared to thwart it?
I think the likelihood of there being some kind of additional malfeasance with cyber attacks or more broadly efforts to influence the outcome of the elections in the United States are certainly possible. Whether they are likely or not is very hard to say. I don't think we entirely understand the Russian political calculation here. I think what we've seen over the last several months is that, one, Russia has some fairly sophisticated technical capabilities, but also a willingness, as you said, that we haven't really seen before to try and directly influence the domestic political process in the United States. And because we haven't seen that before, I think the U.S. government is struggling to come up with a response. It's trying to balance being open about what's happening with protecting intelligence sources and methods. It's trying to balance pushing back against what is a serious escalation in terms of Russian tactics with the desire not to get caught in some kind of an escalatory spiral, either in the cyber domain or more broadly. In a lot of ways, we're in uncharted territory here. And I think until after the presidential election in the United States, it's going to be difficult for the U.S. government, for the Obama administration, to do anything very decisive about it because of the delicate political situation in this country.
Turning to you, Ilya Zaslavsky, for your take on this. As Jeff said, it seems like we are in uncharted territory. Cyber espionage is not new, but this leaking of the documents through WikiLeaks, making it public, perhaps some of them are even doctored. How concerned are you as we approach Election Day that Russia may continue these sophisticated cyber assaults, if not to necessarily throw the election in one direction or another, but just to cause panic, to undermine confidence in our democratic system?
I'm pretty sure they will continue doing it, and they have already done it with other countries, with Estonia, and these hacks have continued around the world. And only now they got this really global attention because of U.S. elections, but it wasn't news for many East European countries. Reportedly, Condoleezza Rice, when she was state secretary, she didn't use email much because of such concerns. And I actually think we have entered a new era of sort of state-level hacking at highest levels. And maybe that's likely to lead actually to more instances of high-level officials not using electronic devices and emails at all, or using them very carefully. As for the specific threats during these elections, I think undoubtedly Russians will try to present elections as rigged. How massively they will interfere, I don't know, but the propaganda is already working on this issue and working it up.
Even if Donald Trump wins?
I would say that they sort of treat these two matters differently. Trump may be a good thing, and his victory is sort of one separate issue, but that democracy is as corrupt and rotten as everybody else in the US, that's been an issue they've been peddling for many years now.
That's a good point. Again, this is the fundamental concern, the fact that they could try to undermine confidence that most Americans have in the system. Well, back to you, Jeffrey Mankoff. Just to talk about what many call our false equivalences. In other words, we have Vladimir Putin, whom we accuse of having illegally annexed Crimea, destabilized eastern Ukraine. But of course, then he would say, well, that's no different than NATO's interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo in the 1990s. The intervention in the U.S. election, he would say, well, that's no different than Hillary Clinton being behind, allegedly behind popular demonstrations against Putin's re-election about 4 years ago. And of course, then Syria, the United States, the West have implicated Russia in bombing Aleppo, attacking innocent civilians, hospitals, even attacking a humanitarian UN convoy. And again, Putin's reaction is, well, it's no different than the US-backed assault on Mosul. Now, we know here in an open democratic society that, you know, these are false equivalences. But how dangerous are these, in your view? And is Russia's increasingly sophisticated internet and satellite TV propaganda operations, are they winning over any segments of Western public opinion, in your view?
I think there are a couple of things that are important here. I mean, one, some equivalences are false, but not all of them are. For example, when the Russians talk about the U.S.-led intervention in the Balkans in the late 1990s and their own interventions in Georgia and Ukraine, there's an element of truth to the comparison. The Russians will say, well, you went in to attack Yugoslavia without the imprimatur of the international community of the United Nations, which is true. So then how can you, the United States, object to us using force in similar, quote-unquote, humanitarian circumstances in Georgia or Ukraine? In Ukraine, of course, the difference is that then Russia went and forcibly annexed territory that belonged to another sovereign state. So there's an element to which there's a certain degree of truth, and I think what the Russian information approach has been is to take that degree of truth, the degree of plausibility behind the comparisons, and then use it in a very deliberate way to imply more than actually should be implied based on the facts of the case. In terms of how much influence this narrative has in the West, it's difficult to say. I do think that there is less effort on persuading audiences in Western countries, including the United States, that Russia is righteous, rather than simply trying to show that great power politics is a messy business, domestic politics in any country is a messy business, and that the U.S. and other Western countries don't have a moral soapbox to stand on and condemn Russia because they're all kind of down playing in the same mud. And if in the process of doing that, Americans and other Western populations start having less faith in their own democratic systems and are more willing to see a kind of moral equivalence between their own systems and the one that exists in Russia, then I think that also has benefits for Russia in terms of its foreign policy because it makes those populations less willing to pay the price to stand up to Russian assertiveness or aggression. And it also pays benefits domestically within Russia because it shows to the Russian public, you see what happens in these democratic countries. They say they're better than what we have here, but that's not actually the case.
Turning to you, Ilya Zaslavsky, to comment on this concern about false equivalences, about the fact that somebody like Vladimir Putin, who controls electronic media and whose increasingly sophisticated internet and satellite TV propaganda operations are not only winning over his own population, but also perhaps trying to influence the West. How concerned are you about this trend?
I think recently the most effective tool that Putin had in the U.S. was the army of trolls. Mostly the trolls that pretend to be Americans. And it has been shown in a number of reports now that large part of online Trump supporters turned out to be trolls.
Russian trolls. Russian,
very likely Russian trolls. It's never possible to prove it completely. Only in very few instances, I think, people did prove it. But I expect considerable noise and impact on that front. Otherwise, I don't think Putin has much positive sort of agenda in U.S. media. It's just the continuous work of Russian propaganda to really undermine confidence in institutions and values throughout Western Hemisphere.
Quickly before we go to a break, in terms of the media in Russia, we understand that it's extremely biased, that is, vis-a-vis the U.S. presidential election, that most of the media basically vilifies Hillary Clinton, whom they know would be tougher on Vladimir Putin's Russia, and in a way glorify Donald Trump. Is that more or less accurate?
They have all sorts of reports, and they have reports for different audiences. They on Echo Moskvy or on primetime news on First Channel, they sort of try to be a bit more responsible and restricted and appear to be balanced. On trashy shows on NTV, they could denigrate everyone and everything in U.S. system. But overall, I think, yes, there is visible support to Trump or sort of at least visible negativity about Hillary Clinton.
You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are Jeffrey Mankoff, he's deputy director and senior fellow with the Russia and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, that's a think tank here in Washington, and Ilya Zaslavsky, from whom you just heard. He's a visiting senior fellow at the Legatum Institute. We are discussing Russia and the West after the U.S. presidential elections. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to Sule Nafio Zangbeo. He's a loyal listener from Ghana. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to you, Jeffrey Mankoff. And let's talk about what we call this lame duck period. We don't know. The election hasn't taken place yet here in the United States. But nonetheless, between the time of the election and the actual inauguration, we have a period of several months during which some mischief could be done, particularly by Vladimir Putin's Russia. How do you see this period as the Obama administration winds down and a new one is not yet in place? Does this present an opportunity for Putin to veer toward more and more brinkmanship, say, in the Baltics, in eastern Ukraine, and in Syria?
To some extent. I think it does depend to a degree on what happens on Tuesday, because if there's a Clinton victory, I think there's going to be a much more seamless transition between the two administrations. I imagine there'll be much more coordination. Nevertheless, I mean, there is a period of uncertainty where you don't know who the people in top positions are necessarily going to be, or they haven't been confirmed by the Senate yet. And so it's a little bit difficult for a new administration to formulate a response to anything. Of course, if there's a Trump victory or like what happened in 2000, where we don't know who the victor is, then I think the prolonged uncertainty in the U.S. and probably the bad blood between the outgoing and potentially incoming administrations creates even more obstacles to developing a coherent policy response. And in that sense, I do think creates opportunities not only for the Russians, but also for other international actors who might wish to take steps to achieve fait accompli that the U.S. would not necessarily be comfortable with.
How do you see that, Ilya Zaslavsky?
To be frank, I wouldn't worry that much about just this 2 months transition period. I'm more worried about long-term lack of coherent, proactive strategy towards Russia. Because just the other day I listened to presidential debates from 2012 and then before that in 2008. And every time presidential candidates, say Obama and Clinton, were saying, we have to have a coherent, proactive strategy. And they never did. So I expect a new president to really face a very tough dilemma. Will they continue to be sort of reactive towards Russian brinkmanship? Or will they really develop a coherent containment strategy or even sort of some compellence on Russia? And in my view, that requires not only sort of revival of NATO or particular strategies towards Ukraine and Syria, but it really involves an enhanced value-based leadership, which would, for example, address the issue of Russian kleptocracy around the world, including in the West, and the price that the West is ready to pay in order to impose proper sanctions, proper containment, the price that the West is ready to, you know, put on itself in terms of financial dealings with Russia, oil and gas issues. So these are very tough long-term issues, which I expect to be very difficult for the new administration.
Turning back to you, Jeffrey Mankoff, What do you see are the options for the new American president in dealing with Russia? And of course, that would depend on how much of a threat you think Russia does pose to the West, to NATO, given its very aggressive actions in the Baltics and eastern Ukraine and in Syria. And of course, it will depend on who wins, Mr. Trump.
I think it will depend quite substantially on who wins. There are a number of challenges here. I mean, one is sort of figuring out where Russia fits in the universe of threats and challenges that not only the United States, but the West, the transatlantic community as a whole, faces. I don't think that there is real transatlantic consensus on that issue right now. Developing a coherent strategy for dealing with Russia over the longer term requires not only the United States, but it requires support and participation from the closest U.S. allies, particularly those in Europe. Countries like France and Germany have their own presidential elections next year, and the role of Russia and relations with Russia are going to be very central issues in those political contexts as well. But, you know, that said, I think if you're the leader of the United States, there are a couple of different approaches you can take, subject, of course, to your ability to get buy-in from the Europeans and others. At one end of the spectrum, and I think if you have a Trump presidency, this is much more likely, you have a kind of bandwagoning or sort of acceptance of Russia as a revisionist power and perhaps an unwillingness to believe that the West does have any moral or other kind of superiority to Russia. I think that would be a profoundly dangerous and damaging course, but it is one option that's available and one that I think if there's a Trump presidency, we may see. Moving up the spectrum, I mean, I think you can move more towards a kind of limited containment policy where you use some of the tools that Ilya described, such as financial sanctions, personal sanctions targeting members of the Russian government, and deployment of additional military forces along frontline states in Eastern Europe.
Which we're doing
in a limited way. The Warsaw Summit of NATO a couple months ago made a decision that there's going to be a permanent rotating presence of a limited number of allied combat forces in Poland and the Baltic states. Now, you know, we're talking about 1,000 troops per country, which is a fairly limited number. It didn't do anything on the southeastern front, and the Romanians and the Bulgarians, among others, remain quite concerned about their vulnerability. So one option is to reinforce the force posture in both the northeast and the southeast, along with the other targeted and economic sanctions that I discussed. On the compellents end of the spectrum, you know, I think the options are somewhat limited. There's been some discussion, certainly within the Clinton camp, about setting up a no-fly zone in Syria, which would, in effect, mean confronting the Russian Air Force that's providing air power for the Syrian regime, and in a sense, risking a confrontation between American and Russian forces, something that Clinton promised to do in one of the debates. Now, whether that's actually a place that a Clinton administration is willing to go, I think, is an open question. And it obviously carries risks of escalation. At the end of the day, I mean, I think the only way forward is on the basis of some kind of new political vision, not only for the relationship with Russia, but also for the nature of the transatlantic alliance. I mean, I think at the end of the day, there's going to be some kind of diplomatic process between the U.S. and its allies on the one hand and Russia on the others. And I think what you're going to see in the first year or so, especially of a Clinton administration, is jockeying to establish position ahead of, you know, those kind of negotiations so that you can deal with the Russians from a position of strength, which is something that right now, given all the economic and political vulnerability that we see both in this country and in Europe, is quite difficult to do.
Well, turning back to you, Ilya Zabrzelewski, to expound upon what you think needs to be done. I think we do understand that if Trump would win, he's much more non-interventionist. He wants to get along with Putin, which probably would cause quite a bit of an alarm among the Baltic states and eastern Ukraine. And in Syria, he talks about cutting a deal in Syria that presumably would leave Bashar al-Assad, a barbarian, a war criminal by all standards, in power. So that's one side. But what about Hillary Clinton, whom we know would be willing to advocate a renewal of sanctions against Russia, try to encourage the Europeans to renew sanctions, perhaps impose more sanctions, a more aggressive posture, as Jeff said, in Syria, not just perhaps a no-fly zone, but maybe recognizing an interim rebel group as the actual legitimate government as opposed to Bashar al-Assad. Again, we don't know these things, but these are some, you know, some ideas. And how do you see that playing out? And how do you assess the period we're in vis-a-vis Russia in terms of the threat it poses in Europe and to the West and to the values that we stand for?
If Trump wins, the biggest question for me is really, does Putin have compromising materials on him or not? Because this is something that's been recently discussed a lot, first about Trump's advisors and now about Trump himself. I mean, there are several issues to that. Is there a lot of oligarchic money invested in Trump's properties? What exactly was Trump up to when he went to Russia? Because there are reports that he may have been a target for Russian security services who tried to recruit him somehow. So that's the biggest threat and danger. If Putin doesn't have compromising materials on him, I expect this relationship to develop in a very unpredictable way, because Trump may be in love with Putin today, but if Putin have compromising materials on him, he is fed up with Putin tomorrow and behaves himself, you know, like President Erdogan of Turkey, who went back and forth between alliance and confrontation with Russia several times on different issues. And for Hillary, I think she will need to deal with different issues on different levels. Syria, I think, is really, it doesn't have quick solution at all. I think it's quite inevitable that the country will be split into zones of influence. I don't see quick resolution to this conflict. As for Ukraine, a lot depends, in my view, on Ukrainian people themselves, on civil society activists and development of government there. Obviously, U.S. would need to take a much more robust leadership position in Ukraine, enhancing their army, enhancing their development programs. But unless Ukrainians themselves are ready to execute these programs, nothing will happen. As for overall potential relationship between the West and Russia in Europe and in international organizations, in international trade, I think there is an interesting fact that it's Putin who has really instigated some of the cohesion in Western alliances by downing the Malaysian airplane, by enacting some other horrific things. So if he continues to build up alliance in such a way, then Clinton will have less problems. If Putin decides to tactically sort of pacify the West for some time, I wouldn't exclude decoupling of sanctions between U.S. and Europe, because there are many pro-Russian factions in Europe who are really eager to remove sanctions and to get back to business as usual. And in that case, Hillary Clinton would really be faced with a situation where she needs to take very strong leadership positions. She would maybe have to go alone with sanctions against Russia.
I'm not sure if I understood what you meant by Putin coming up with material on Trump. Are you trying to say he would try to undermine President Trump?
Well, there's been several reports recently published by New York Times and some other outlets saying that there is a former FBI officer who investigated Trump's connections to Russia, that there are oligarchic money in his assets. Then there was a report that maybe there is some compromising material in the hands of Russian security on Trump.
So what are the implications of all that?
Well, if that is true, if Putin does have compromising materials on Trump, then it's huge. Obviously, Trump would probably not want those compromising materials to appear.
What do you think about that, Jeff?
I've seen the media reports. It's hard to say. You know, at this point, there's not enough in the public domain about Trump personally and his financial and other potential ties to Russian government and other entities. To the extent that these ties exist, they benefit the Russians, because it has been the case with a lot of Russian domestic political figures. If they're afraid of certain information coming out, then they're more willing to act in a way that the Kremlin sees as being beneficial. It's a way of exerting influence through what amounts essentially to blackmail over the individual who's targeted.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Ilya Zaslavsky. He's a visiting senior fellow at the Legatum Institute, and Jeffrey Mankoff. He's deputy director and senior fellow with the Russia and Eurasian program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks so much for your terrific insights.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Linus Rimkus. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.